This is Georgie, and I'm here asking you to lend us a hand giving someone else a hand. Please go to giveforward.com/givemichelleyahand, and let's give her a second hand. Thank you.
Indie Nation listeners, you are about to hear Indie Nation's weekly tech, net, news, and opinion, a weekly wrap-up of news and how it impacts you. The production is streamed live each Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with listener participation on IndieNation.fm. To find out how you can get involved, listen in at the end of the show.
Although pretty much everywhere, I caught the news of this via my Engadget RSS feed. Google Music has launched and offered over 8 million tracks on the first day. The selection of music will soon increase to over 13 million. While the music program has been known and in beta, there was speculation as to which and how many labels would be on board. Engadget reports that 3 major labels and 23 independents have signed on.
Yeah, and that's not exactly earth-shattering news, in my opinion. What do you guys think?
It almost sounds like they're trying to compete with Mevio, or, you know, it's...
Well, Mevio is a little bit different in the sense that it's more for musicians and producers. And that's what we use a lot of is Mevio's Music Alley for the open source music we play here. But almost everybody's gotten into some type of music distribution. And by music distribution, more specifically, I think we should say the new media order distribution, you know, where it's electronic.
It seems like a lot of what they want to do is keep people from going to Amazon or going to with iTunes on the iPhones. They want to keep them from going to those because they seem very similar in what they're starting to offer, you know, when they start describing what Google Music is going to do.
Oh, and just for Yoda's benefit, why don't you introduce yourself, Steve?
Oh, my name is Steve Bostwick. People call me Boz, and...
And he's one of the DJs here. You know what, Brian? We should probably, right quick, Cletta is a long, long time listener to Lumpy, going all the way back to even before the Geeks Radio days, when I was just doing podcasting, and when I was literally running Winamp server in my living room.
We can do it like an Indie Nation listeners, live from Tennessee, live from Michigan, live from Cleveland, you know what I mean? It's like we're all over the... all over the map.
But Steve has done DJ work, since your 20s?
Yeah, basically, yeah, since college. On all sorts of levels, in clubs and radio stations and done news writing. And
yeah, Steve's a published author. He used to write for USA Rocker, and he used to write for Cleveland PM Magazine, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, and then the CSU Cauldron, I wrote for them, and I worked at UJC at John Carroll and WCSB at Cleveland State. And then I did a little one-off stint over at Case with a friend of mine.
And Steve and Lumpy are coming cyber live, as Lumpy always likes to say it, from Cleveland, Ohio, in what we call Cold Crank Studios. And the listeners don't usually hear it, but a lot of times the TeamSpeak participants hear it. At the end of the street is a truck depot, and across the street is a motorcycle repair shop. Thus the name Cold Crank Studios.
Yeah, because thanks for this nice wall of egg cartons. It blocks out a lot of that noise, but
yeah, the egg cartons really do work. And Brian, why don't you tell the listeners where you're from and what you're about, and then we'll let Cletta go next.
All right. Well, my name is Brian Aldridge. I'm from Boise, Idaho, and I'm a computer consultant here with Boise Computer Service. I also do work with a group called Hangout Canopy on Google+. We developed a Google Plus extension. So some of the people on Google Plus know me through that. But yeah, I do a podcast and have a blog called Bite of Tech. It's BITE, as in taking a bite of tech.com.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, I just checked out your Hangout Canopy the other day, and that looks like a really cool app. Why don't you tell them a little bit more about that right quick?
All right. Well, when using Google Plus and doing a lot of Hangouts, we really found that there was a problem with finding hangouts that were on your stream, because it seemed like if you followed a lot of people, hangouts would just go flying by, and you would miss a bunch of hangouts with people that you normally would want to hang out with. So we decided that we wanted to create an extension that would, inside of the browser, you know, you click a button and a drop-down menu comes up, and it would list all the hangouts that are available to you. But then we wanted to go a little bit beyond that, and so we decided that rather than just show your hangouts, we would create a network of everyone who uses the extension, and so they all communicate together, and they share their the public hangouts, not any of the limited ones. It'll share any public hangout that you see with everyone else on the network. So someone who perhaps follows 50 people, 100 people on Google Plus won't see that many hangouts, and this gives them access to thousands of people's walls of hangouts. So it's been really popular. We just released in the Chrome extension web store, and we have, I think, like 4,000 or 5,000 users, you know, right away, and we have about 2,000, I think, active users at any time. So it's really has grown just in the last, this past week, less than a week, when we released our new version and officially released it, you know, in the store.
I think that's awesome, especially, you know, the explosive growth. Kudos to you on that. And, you know, Cleta, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Cleta. I've known Monty for quite a while now. You can usually find me on GeekShed and PoundCleta or PoundIndieNation. I'm Cleta E on Twitter as well, and I have a Google Plus account as well. You can also find me there, and I'm always listening to IndieNation. That's my favorite radio station.
Well, we're going to have some more new and different programming coming up on Indie Nation in the near future, but I want to touch back on this Google Music. Well, I don't think it's exactly earth shattering. I did put a post up over at Lumpy's Corner, over at Torrent Freak, and I think this ties in. It's a little bit different, but basically the reason I don't think it's earth shattering, in my opinion, is it's just basically giving the consumers what they want. You know, I really don't want CDs anymore. I know some people like them. I know Cleta loves getting them. But I want it on my thumb drive. I want it on my hard drive. I want it on my phone. And I want it now.
I still like looking at artwork.
I agree with you there.
You know, that's the one thing about the record albums, even, that I miss, is the nice 12x12 painting or picture of something, you know.
But would you guys agree or disagree? In general, the average consumer, do you think they want the MP3 now or the CD?
Oh, I'd have to agree.
I think it's definitely MP3. You know, a lot of people don't want to go to the store and have a CD that they're then going to have to rip to their computer, and they paid more just because it's a physical product. Now with the phones, I mean, you pretty much have an MP3 player in your pocket. That all you have to do is hook headphones into or use a Bluetooth headset. And I think, you know, with Google, they really want to create a all-around full solution. You know, with everything that they make, they want to incorporate everything and not have you go somewhere else to get it. So, you know, I think that with them, you know, starting to sell music, I think, is a natural next step, since they want you to store the music on a device that the operating system is made by them.
And this is where I think my little post over at Lumpy's Corner ties in with the, it's just like I said, giving the consumer what they want. Mike Masnick over at Tech Dirt often talks about the fact that piracy is not occurring because of profit or stealing money. It's occurring because of convenience and how people want to receive their media. And this article over at Torrent Freak, I did a real quick summary of it over at Lumpy's Corner, and he makes some assumptions and he makes some generalizations, but basically, very convincing argument based on what's going on. Number one, Netflix has more internet traffic than torrents. Now, torrents are what people typically call peer-to-peer or file sharing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, because I know you're more the tech geek, but basically it means all of us have a piece of something on our computer and we all share it. And the MPAA and the RIAA pretty much think that equals piracy, right?
Yeah, I think they seem to view that, you know, people that even make a backup of their own DVD. I think when that first started happening, people viewed that as piracy, because I think they've thought that making a copy of anything that's on a physical media was piracy. And, you know, making it so that you're not supposed to, you know, rip a CD or rip a DVD, you know, they turn that into a negative thing when, you know, for me, if I'm going to have, you know, for when I have kids, if I want to give them a DVD to watch, I'm not going to give them my original DVD because I don't want them scratching it up and making it unreadable. You know, I want to be able to make a copy, make a backup, because I bought that, you know, whatever it is, that's mine. And I think that they have a really tricky time dealing with digital purchases, but because can you give a digital purchase away? You know, I think they're still trying to figure that out. And I think they reach a little too broad every time.
But I mean, really? I mean, they want to try and make it illegal for you to back up and copy your own material that you own?
They've been trying to do that since the introduction of the 8-track.
I mean, that's just absurd. You know?
Well, with digital items, though, that seems to be, you know, what, it's a new area for these different organizations.
I think the bottom line is, though, is what he concluded with his rough calculations is that the MPAA membership cost Hollywood more money annually than piracy.
Yeah, definitely. I think that we're going to see with the, you know, if you look at Netflix, you brought up Netflix. I think that that is an excellent example of people want subscription-based services because, I mean, you buy something, you listen to it for a period of time, you know, unless you want to listen to it over and over and over again constantly and have it with you. I think people are perfectly happy with having a subscription to where, say, I pay this amount per month and I can access all these different songs to listen to whenever I want. I think that that's a lot of where these type of things are going towards is you don't really own, you know, anything individually, but you have the rights to access them. That's what you're paying for, kind of like what they do with Netflix. You don't own any of those movies, but you're paying for the right to watch them whenever you want to.
Well, you know, another related one, and I don't have it in front of me, but I know it's either going to be a news story on Indie Nation pretty soon or it's already posted. What about this Regidigit or Redigit? Basically, they're claiming that you can legally resell your electronic MP3 iTunes song.
Yeah, I saw that, and I thought that was kind of interesting because realistically, I mean, it's exactly the same thing as you owning a CD, right? When you buy a song in iTunes, you own that license, and you should have the ability to turn around and sell that license to someone else if you no longer want to listen to that song and no longer want to own it.
I don't know if that's going to hold up in the courts, though, because the previous court decision was regarding some actual physical software on a CD. Now, the argument against by the RIAA and the MPAA will be the fact that it went to the server means you actually copied it.
Yeah, and this is different than physical things because it gets really tricky in proving, unless they have some sort of an authentication system, proving that you no longer have that software. You know, with a CD, if you wanted to, you could make a copy of it. So I guess it is the same thing, but, you know, if you turn around and sell that CD, I think that would be the exact same thing as the iTunes store because you still have a copy of it and you're selling your copy of it. So I don't, you know, if you look at a physical media, are you selling the physical disc? I mean, is that what you're actually selling? Or are you selling the song itself?
Yeah, and Yoda is in Geek Shed, and he brought up a point. We mentioned the MP3. He says he also likes the CDs because of higher qualities. And FLAC, he's talking about, which is lossless. You know, MP3 is lossy. It's considered compressed. It's not the entire spectrum. And some serious audiophiles would argue that anything digital is lossy. However, there's some rules of thumb where we think you're not going to lose anything. But that's all still theory. However, going along with what he's saying, I think the reason the MP3 is so popular is because of limited storage space in the past. In this day and age, I think you may see more higher quality recordings coming out. And you may see more people going to FLAC or the less lossless compression. What is it, Orbis Vorg or I think it's OGG is the extension. It's kind of on the tip of my tongue.
Well, I think they really need to move away from what we know as the CD because, you know, if you look in a car, they still have CD players. which are based on technology from the 90s, you know, I mean, from the early mid 90s, you know, people were having CDs. And I think that, you know, they need to find another standard. Either, you know, we've talked about doing the, you know, having more like internet radio in your car. They may need to just start new and put, whether it's, if you're going to have a disc, like a DVD, you know, I mean, you can even have a Blu-ray. That's a ton of music, you but might, having you, something else.
You might even have the little USB port, whatever it is that you plug the thumb drive into, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is nowadays the thumb drives are much bigger than CDs and they're bigger than DVDs. I mean, if you want, you could just have a thumb drive or some sort of a device that plugs into your computer. You sync your music to it. You plug it into your car. I mean, it's pretty much what an iPod is, but there's no standard. I mean, it shouldn't be stuck to one company. They need to come up with a standard for music so that, you know, just like, you know, if whether it's some sort of USB port or something to where you can integrate, whether it's your phone or a portable music player into a car device to where if you want to play FLAC on it, you can.
Now, on this note about, like, the cars typically have CDs, I mentioned earlier 8-tracks. Now, I kid you not, I remember when I was younger buying an album, and inside the album what was folded up to look like a newspaper article. It was really, you know, a leaflet, and it was put out by the recording industry, was an article, it's what you were supposed to believe it was, about how the 8-track recorder is going to destroy the music industry.
Yeah.
And I'm over at Tech Dirt right now, and we're going to jump back to this SOPA issue towards the end of our recording here. However, I've always said this, and I could never find it or recall exactly where, but back in the days of the player piano even, the sheet music industry sued the player piano industry because it was going to destroy music. And Mike Masnick's got an interesting quote up there. I foresee a marked deterioration in American music and a host of other injuries to music in its artistic manifestations by virtue, or rather by vice, of the multiplication of the various musical reproducing machines. John Phillips Sousa. The established industry has always fought the newer technology. And it goes back even earlier than that. Remember the telegraph? I mean, I don't personally remember it, but I know what it is.
Samuel Morse.
Did you know that American Telegraph had it written into their contracts back in the day that if they put phones in their hotel, they were no longer going to be allowed to have a Western Union or a telegraph office in there? I mean, it goes all the way back to that. I don't know. I think anybody else got any wrap-up comments on that one?
I think once you have something like where you're able to put a thumb drive in the car, as long as you're able to program it to play the music continuous, you might see the end of CDs as we know it. Because, you know, on a thumb drive, you can store pictures, so you can still have the artwork, you know. You can still have an image that represents the music. You can, you know, there's a whole host of things that you can do. I mean, you're able to store books on there. You're able to store.
Well, and I think that this is really where, you know, Lee, you look at this online music thing that they have. I think that's where this is starting to go is, you know, if we talked about having streaming radio in cars, I think it's going to become to where you have a computer in your car, which is kind of like what your phones are, to where it logs into your Google Music account and you have access to your full library of music. It's in the cloud. You know, your email's there, your pictures are there, all these different things. You can stream, you know, online radio stations. I think that, you know, they're starting to do that with entertainment systems. And, you know, it started with the Xbox 360. And I think that the next step is going to be in our cars, having similar things built into cars to where you can have the music, you can have your pictures, you can have, you know, your kids' games, if they want to play games, all kinds of things built into the car.
I have to agree with you, and I have some personal experience with a very much older machine these days. People in Locker Gnome used to tease me for years, and Chris for years, because I was, quote, one of six people in the world that had ME edition, you know, Millennium Edition, running and operating. And I literally ran the machine for 12 years. It was an old Creative M003 motherboard. It was the first computer they ever thought about making it a multimedia device. And as far back as 97, it was all over the internet how to modify them to put them in your trunk and run the pins out for the remote control that came with it for your media. Now, back in those days, the catch-22 was your hard drives got beat up. You know, vibration, bumps. I'm sure you can elaborate on that a lot, Brian.
But, yeah, but now that the memories, you know, the hard drives, they're getting away from the spinning hard drives, they're getting to the solid state. I think that's the key.
I think the Blu-ray may be the last physical medium we see.
Could be. Yeah. But, I mean, you watch some kook will come up with bringing 8-tracks back just for shit's sake, you know?
Yoda. Well, I think
now you can stream high definition, you know, over the internet, and you know soon they'll be able to do 3D as bandwidth gets there, you know, over the internet with no problems. And I think that's where it's all going. They expect you to be connected.
Yoda was mentioning in IRC as well that he was at Abe Lincoln's place, and they had an old player organ there, and they've now transcribed the roll music over to a floppy to play it because the roll music was deteriorating.
So that's the only way to save it. Like, well, that's pretty interesting.
I mean,
that's like certain things you have to digitally remaster it just to keep it alive and there, you know. Remember, even all the old albums, you know, your early Beatle records and Bill Haley records, all that was done on analog, you know, so that eventually it gets digitally remastered, and there's no telling how long that music will last now. I mean, you kind of have a new original, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I just think, and you know, let's go ahead. I'm going to read I was wrong. It's actually part of what I had drafted. We mentioned this Redigi. The RIAA does not like the used digital music sale business. This is one we may wish to file under no surprise. After all, there are outdated, make-no-sense lobby and sue to make it our way business model. What part of the music business does the music industry actually love? This is the same organization that tried to stop 8-tracks, cassettes, and used record stores, for they were all certainly going to destroy the music business. Thanks to the ingenious strategy of sue 'em all and total alienation of their customers, the Racketeering Idiots Association of Absurdity has kept the dying business alive for decades. Unfortunately, when they are done paying the organization's officers, legal fees, and lawyers, there's nothing left for the artist. Slashdot points to a few good articles relevant to Redigi, a company which is claiming to resell digital music. The RIAA has sent Redigi a letter, more or less telling them to stop. This one should be interesting one to follow. Will it reverse the decision of Werner versus Autodesk Incorporated? And that's the one I was referring to that was specifically regarding a physical copy of software. Or will the industry stance of first sale win? Unfortunately, with both the U.S. legal system and the RIA involved, one has no clue what a court may decide. While I'm not too sure reselling digital media is actually legal, the case referenced was more specifically involving software, not music, software purchased and physically resold. As for the music, sooner or later, a line must be drawn in the litigious sand that fills the litter box of the current war over content distribution and ownership. So yeah, I mean, is the digital copy really yours to resell? I mean, most terms of service, I'm sure, are going to say it's not.
That gets back to when the big controversy of Garth Brooks suing some of these record store chains that buy used records and resell them, you know, because the musicians don't collect a royalty off of it. But the thing of it is, the musicians have already collected the royalty off of it from the initial purchase. And once it's that piece of material is bought, the consumer owns it. So that's the consumer's right to sue or to sell that, you know, that recording or that album, you know, if it's trading it in for a different disc, you know, because they're not always paid out on cash. A lot of them are done on trade. So, you know, that it's the same thing.
Is it?
For all intents and purposes, yeah.
I mean, well, actually, there is a line. If I took a CD and made a copy of it and then sold it...
Well, that's different.
Okay, so...
But if you're taking your original and selling that original copy of the CD to somebody, that's your right. That's your prerogative to do that.
That's clearly what's in the letter of the law. But if I made a copy of it before I sold the original, did I violate the law?
You'd have to destroy your copy.
Technically, yes.
And I think this should all be in some sort of a license. You know, I think if you're going to start purchasing music online, they should have, what is your license to that music? Do you truly own it? Or, you know, is this a use license? What is it? And I think that that's what they haven't really nailed down is the music that you buy. What is it?
And it's going to be a difficult thing to nail down. I think basically what the consumer wants, disagree with me if you think I'm wrong, anybody in on this.
Well, I think with the RIAA, it's not about what the consumer wants. You know, I think they're protecting their own interests.
Oh, certainly they are. Certainly they are. As a matter of fact, I didn't draft anything on it. I just caught it in my news feeds today. Apparently some online indie music site had put out whether, you know, what their sales were per artist and what the artist made for July, which was apparently a pretty weak month for them. And some of the industry people said, look at this. This guy only made a couple $100. This guy only made $1,000. And they're all, this is just an example of how horrible it is being outside the industry standard. And the rebuttal from the site was, well, wait a minute. If they were within the industry standard, they wouldn't have made anything.
Right.
You see, the MPAA and the Recording Industry Association of America as well would both like the consumer to believe that the industries are losing money, when in fact more and more artists are in fact making money, and more money is being made annually by the entertainment industry every single year over the past 12, with the exception of one. And the problem is, it used to be the big 7 record labels, and now what is it, the big 4 or maybe even the big 3? That big conglomerate association isn't controlling all of it anymore.
No.
And I just missed Yoda leaving. It was nice having him here, though. Now, this is all intellectual property stuff. A lot of lawsuits going on with that for music recording and downloading. What about some of the other intellectual property, like Motorola buying Google? What do you think about that one? Brian, maybe you want to read that one and talk about it? Because I think that's right up your alley, Mr. iPhone versus Droid.
Definitely. All right. Well, following up on a recent old news, more specifically the recent Google bought Motorola stories, first off, to clarify what I have often heard, Google did not buy Motorola in entirety, specifically only Motorola Mobility, in Lumpy's opinion, likely for patents to defend the Droid phone. They announced sticking to a hands-off approach regarding operations. The purchase, however, likely needed final approval from the actual owners of Motorola. According to a post on fizz.org, Google's purchase of Motorola Mobility was given final approval by the Motorola stockholders. The deal was valued at $12.5 billion. Of note, however, though no problem is expected, the regulator has still not officially approved this purchase.
Yeah, why do you think they bought it?
Well, I think that if you look at their Nexus, which is pretty much a Google phone, the way that they were distributing it didn't seem to really take off, and so I think what they're really trying to do is get on a physical phone that sells, and I think they look at Motorola, they seem to put out, with Ice Cream Sandwich and these different versions of Android, Motorola has always put out their operating systems more quickly than others. And the original Droid phone is what people considered Android to be. I mean, people didn't really know what Android was, and they called it, they thought that the Droid phone was Android. And you started seeing all these phones coming out. But I think Motorola really was the leader, with Android. And I think that, you know, with the hardware, they needed someone who put out hardware, so they weren't just putting out one phone, and it was hardware that people bought. And because I really think they want to put out phones that have the latest and greatest, like Ice Cream Sandwich just got released. I think they want to put those phones out that a lot of people are going to buy, and not have it be a novelty that, you know, Verizon carries, that all these different carriers carry. But, and so this was the step they needed to do. And I think a lot of people associate the two together.
See, I can see where you're coming from with that, but I'm not sure I 100% agree with you on it, because I'm also aware of these iPhone intellectual property threats going back and forth between Google and Apple. Some other people thought
legal reasons.
A lot of people feel it was to get the patents so that they, you know, had legal standing to keep developing this operating system. People also thought it was to get into the Motorola cable boxes, but I don't know if that's part of Motorola mobility or not. I didn't mention it when I drafted it, but I probably should. Google also promised to keep a hands-off approach on the operations, and, you know, it's basically just buying that division to own it. You know, they say they're not going to get involved with all of that.
I think that to a point they should, though. Like, if you look at Motorola, I think that it will change some of the things about the Motorola phones. If you look at the Droid and the Droid 2 and the Droid 3 and then the soon coming out Droid 4, you know, they all have locked bootloaders, and so it makes it really difficult when you want to put the newest version of Android on your phone. And so I'm hoping that, you know, with these new phones that come out, that they'll start unlocking that bootloader so that you can upgrade your own version of Ice Cream Sandwich and these different, you know, versions of Android that are coming out later. I want to be able to put those on my phone and not have it be locked down. And I think, you know, with the Nexus, it's an unlocked phone. You have the ability to do that. I'm hoping that they do that the same thing with all these Motorola devices in the future.
Pardon my cave-dwelling mind, but what is Ice Cream Sandwich?
Is the newer version of Android. So it's a combination of, I think it was Honeycomb, and then what most people currently have on their phone. And it takes the Honeycomb was for tablets, and then you had your normal Android that you have on your phones, and it combines those two versions to make a tablet friendly and phone friendly operating system. And it has a new interface. It looks different than what the phones look like right now. And it's supposed to be pretty cool. They put a lot of advanced features in it, and you'll start seeing it roll out on phones here in the next month, 2 months.
Oh, hey, Knowles and Caleb are both in the default channel, so we have to drag them in. I don't want to cut you off with what you're saying on the phones and mobility and all that. We were talking lawsuits earlier. Cletta did have an interesting question, too. We're kind of bridging two areas of IP right now in our conversation, you know, that with the music and the recording industry and the motion picture industry, and that with patent rights. Now, in the context, they're all really the same thing. Now, a couple interesting things, because I've been following intellectual property law for about 14 years now, blogging about it, writing about it. Steve might not catch it. I think almost everybody else. You know what a DMCA is, Brian?
Yes.
Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Boy, I was so against that. I read the actual bill that was proposed. And that's the one that...
I've heard of that. I've read about that. But, I mean, I go on, Lumpy.
Steve didn't believe me when I told him.
I just found it very hard to believe. It was so ridiculous and absurd. I just had to do the research myself to see it for my own two eyes.
But here's where Cletta's question really ties into all of this.
Where she's talking about the Groove Shark thing.
And you know why they're shutting down? Universal sued them.
Now, what is Groove Shark?
Cletta, you care to elaborate?
My ignorance again.
Cletta would know more about it than me.
It's music sharing utility. You can make a music list, etc., and share your music that you're listening to with Grooveshark. And Universal is suing them now. They're going to be shutting down because they can't afford the lawsuit that Universal is laying against them. And my question is, what about YouTube. You know, that's along the same line as Graveshark. And I'm sure that Universal, I don't think, could touch them in a lawsuit if they tried that, you know.
That was the first thing I thought of when you mentioned that. I mean, I myself, I got 3 different MySpace pages, and each MySpace page has a playlist of, like, top songs. And then on my YouTube channel, I've got playlists. I mean, a whole horde of them. I mean, and I've got, like, a list of great French rock, a list of Japanese rock. I've got my favorite Kiss stuff, my favorite Sabbath stuff. I mean, you go on and on and on. I've got all kinds of different video lists. So, I mean, why would anybody have a problem with that? To me, that's just...
That's what
dumb.
I don't understand, because, I mean, it's just a utility to listen to the music. You're not actually downloading the music. You know, I understand that they're taking their music and letting you listen to it, but you're not stealing their music per se. You're just listening to it.
I can tell you, I can give you a little story here. There's a band that from the 60s called Coven. They did the theme song for the movie Billy Jack. Their singer, she put together a bunch of videos, just pulled a bunch of videos out of her vaults and uploaded them on YouTube. And I had saved several of them, you know. Well, unfortunately, because what you're just talking about, you're not sharing. You almost wish that you were actually able to share and keep, because this lady had a fire and lost the master copies of these videos, and they cannot be retrieved, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and then she asked me if I still had the copy that I saved. I said, well, no, it wouldn't let me keep it. It, you know, it's borrowed from you, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, it was just a utility to listen to the music, and now they're taking him down. And I'm just thinking, are they just picking on the little guy because they can, you know?
Well, that's kind of where this copyright war versus patent war varies a little bit. With the DMCA and what they want to do with SOPA, which is the one we'll read next, you are basically accused, legal action is taken, and then you have the burden to prove yourself innocent. Okay? The COPA, and I can't remember what that stands for, but basically, the anti-piracy law that was passed recently, last year, they took down over almost 300 websites. They just shut them down. They're gone. You get a little you get a little FBI logo when you show up, because the people in the industry told the government, hey, these people are pirating our product, and they're counterfeiting our property. The Counterfeit Online Protection Act, that's what COPA stood for. And the website owner is not warned. They're not notified. They're shut down. Okay?
Wow.
They took down another 150 sites yesterday and today.
Really?
Really.
I didn't know that.
And that is why I always had a problem with the DMCA. And we'll get on to SOPA and this PIPA in a little bit.
All these acronyms.
But it's with the patent wars, they still have to take you to court right now. So that's a subtle difference there. Anybody else got anything on that?
I have a theory. I mean, yes, I understand the law, and as a radio station here at Indie Nation, of course, we go by the rules and we do get permits to play the music we play. But I do have a theory that if you took music that is obsolete and is out of print, and you know it just never went anywhere, and you made some kind of a station like ours out of it, I bet it would go under the radar. But I doubt they would ever notice it, ever.
But then when you reach a certain critical mass like Grooveshark did, they're going to come after you. You see?
Yeah, I think they'd let things go until you start making money. I think once you're successful, then they feel like they have the rights to come in because they want a piece of that money. I mean, a lot of it has to do not with really the artists, protecting the artists, but, you know, it comes down to the money.
And it's kind of sad because I can't remember the actual year, but I think it was like copyright is not that old a concept. And copyright originally came along with the printing press and was made law because of the printing press, because the printing press was a considerable investment of capital. And What they wanted to protect was those risk takers that had invested and gone through all the drafting by hand in those days. Got to remember, the printing press came along before the typewriter. So you had to have somebody write it and rewrite it and manually set all the type and rub the ink on and rub that one page over. It was a very laborious process. And what started to happen immediately after the printing press is there were rogue printing press operations. So that's why copyright law came into time. But back in that day, it was closer to the Renaissance. And they understood the concept of free thought a little bit differently than we do. I think they appreciated it more. It was meant to be a temporary thing. After 25 years, it was no longer protected under copyright, and it became a term that we know that they're trying to exercise from our vocabulary, public domain, which meant anybody in the world could then take that work and creatively build on it and creatively share it. And that's how libraries came to be, you know. Libraries were basically archives of stuff, not necessarily, you know, only public domain, but...
I mean, that's interesting, because I always wondered, like, how did the library ever start? Where was the
first... Well, the library started before the printing press by far, because you had to collect all the knowledge in one place. I mean, the Library of Alexandria, you know, right. Goes back to the ancient Romans, but...
So what do you think about that ebook? I mean, if you look at the ebooks with what Amazon's doing, you know, they're lending ebooks. You know, I think that is... pretty much what a library is. I think it's very similar. It's pretty much exactly the same thing.
Well, you know, the major publishers have the archive.org is on their list of sites that facilitate piracy. I'm serious. They were asked to put together a list. And archive.org, the Internet Archive, which is basically the Internet Library, is on that list. How do you guys feel about that?
Well, if you look under their terms, under their definition of what piracy is, they would be, because if you look at, I think, isn't it the Wayback Machine? That's based off of archive.org.
That is, yes.
Where it takes, you know, what the website looked like. Do they have the legal rights to, you know, to have the pictures that are on those websites and have all that information on there? No, but it's an archive. It's something that they're not trying to profit from it. They're saying, here's so that you can see the information as it was at that point in time. And, you know, I think that, you know, for them, they would say, oh, that's piracy, because they have something on that site that they don't have a legal license to.
I agree that as far as their viewpoint is, it may be piracy. But my questions are for everybody. I've got two of them. Number one, you know, is that really piracy in the context of why was copyright meant to be temporary in the first place? And where do you draw the line? By their definition, the way we're looking at it, let's say I had you, now Steve's over here physically, but let's say I had the rest of you over here physically, and I just purchased a copy of, I don't know, let's say The Lady with the Dragon Tattoo. Now, I paid for my right to view that, right? So if I have 15 people over here watching it, do I have to pay extra license fees? I bet you if you ask people in the industry, they would argue that you should.
Yeah.
Yeah, they see it as a public viewing or something.
So it really is kind of insane. Another thing that's actually insane, okay, now you got to think about this, and I know it was probably from Tech Dirt, but don't quote me. With the way they've changed the copyright law to be able to extend it and extend it and extend it and extend it, Walt Disney stuff is never going to become unprotected, because they'll renew it every year, I guarantee you. That means that Disney will legally have the right to sue any school they want for painting Mickey Mouse murals on their wall forever.
Well, I mean, I'm a designer of headstones by trade, okay? I've used Mickey Mouse... I've used Felix the Cat.
You could be sued.
I've used Chief Wahoo. I've done Steeler logos.
Oh, I agree.
You know? I mean, theoretically speaking, technically there's supposed to be permits you obtain to use that artwork, but...
But you know how ridiculous...
It's...
You know how ridiculously extended the copyright has gone? And the trademark extensions have gone? A plastic plane. A plastic toy plane. Okay, of a B-17.
We're getting into the model numbers here.
No, wait. This is actually what I read about. And this is, I'm almost positive it was Techdirt. A plastic model plane of a B-17 has more protection in years for intellectual property than the actual patents for the real plane.
I could believe that, though.
Is that ridiculous and inappropriate, though?
It is ridiculous. It's still, it's still ridiculous. I mean, you know, they're worried about the secret getting out of, you know, this, but you know, specific design of the plane and.
No. They're worried about. That's not what I'm saying, though. I'm saying just the opposite. The secret of the plane has less legal protection in terms of years than the toy plane.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood that. I'm thinking that the actual plane has protection. Not as much as the... Well, then, now that's even more stupid.
What do you think of that, Brian?
Does that qualify as a stupidest charge?
Yeah, I think it is pretty ridiculous. I mean, if you look at, with that, they could, once again, it's about the money. You know, if you look at with the plane, it becomes outdated. They can't make any more money off of it after a certain point, and so they let it drop off. You know, with the toy plane, they figure they can always have an opportunity to make money off of that. You know, if anyone ever wants to replicate it and make a toy, or if it ever wants to be used in a movie, all these things. I mean, it comes down to, can we make money off of it? You know, and so they're going to sue anybody who tries to use it in any other way.
We're coming up on the 1 hour mark on the recording, so we're going to roll over onto SOPA pretty quickly. You mentioned the profit margin, the profit incentive. Now, I want you guys to think about something. These COPA takedowns, these DMCA takedowns, very realistically, in my opinion, the only difference between censorship and a COPA takedown and a DMCA takedown or a SOPA or a PIPA in the near future, potentially, hopefully not, because a lot of people are upset about it, is the profit margin or the profit incentive. What's your thought on that? I mean, you know, I've got a monetary reason to take you down now. Before it would be like I just had a government and I was a tyrant.
I think there are some forms of piracy, you know, that are actually damaging, but I think the people that are going to be hurt, aren't going to be those, because those places are out of the country right now. I think it's just making more loophole or more hoops that we have to jump through as consumers and as companies that are releasing software. I think it becomes more difficult once they start regulating everything like this. I think that's all this does is lead to more regulations.
I don't think it really does anything for piracy, like we were saying earlier. It's not about, with the consumer, it's not about stealing. It's about what they want, convenience-wise.
Take a look at Steam. If you look at Steam, I don't know if any of you purchase games on Steam, which is Steam powered is what it's officially called. But you can get games on there and you can purchase them and you have a digital copy of that game. And I think you've seen a lot of people, having it to where it's easy access like that has made it so tons more people are buying games when they normally would have pirated them. I think that if they do make it easier to get to where you can get it on all your different computers and there's less of those regulations, I think that makes a huge difference.
I'd have to agree. And I mean, the thing is, I can't remember his name. And when I do, the senator that wrote Larry Page, did you hear about that one?
No, I didn't.
I think there's two issues on it from the consumer or the citizen side. And one of them is simply freedom of speech, which is, of course, immediately tied in with the others, which is censorship. Senator Joel Lieberman wrote a letter to Larry Page about this terrorist that was just arrested in New York, saying, hey, Blogger hosted him. There's no terrorist flag button on Blogger like YouTube. Fix that. He also said something, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but the private sector plays a major role was the word he used, in protecting us against terrorist Islamic extremist. Now, keep in mind that this same arrested terrorist was on the FBI's list. The FBI decided he was not a threat and decided not to investigate. My question is Google more accountable than the FBI? What's the FBI's role in this?
Well, evidently they didn't want to have a role in it.
You know? But think about it this way. Yes, the man may likely be a terrorist. Yes, he may have used the internet to do his terrorism. I kind of think it's parallel and analogous with gun control. Okay, does the criminal care if the gun's legal?
No.
Okay. Do the criminals still not get the guns, even if they're illegal?
Right.
Right. So why not just restrict everybody's right to own a gun?
Well, I think they need to realize it's not the private sector's, like with Blogger, it's not their job to monitor for terrorists. I think, you know, if the government's going to get mad, I think what they need to do is make an easy way for people to report suspicious activity, you know, whether it's online or, you know, it's around you, you know, in your physical area. I think that, you know, if they, rather than saying, oh, Blogger, you have to put these measures in place to be able to report, why doesn't the government have a place where you can submit information in a way that gets responded to by the correct people, rather than making a company like Google incorporate it into a consumer product? You know, I really don't like the government getting in and telling private companies what they have to do when it's something that's not that private company's business. It's not what their goal is in whatever product they're selling or what they're making.
And here's where it goes right back to the consumer versus the government and the big business. It's a heck of a lot easier legally, because there's no legalities involved. There's no court. There's no judge. There's no due process. If the senator or the Recording Industry Association of America can call Google and just say, hey, take that down.
See, that's where I draw the line. I think you should be proven guilty. You should be innocent until proven guilty. You know, not guilty until proven innocent. That's just...
Well, I think the government wants also to hand it off on the, you know, like Blogger, because I think, you know, if we rely on them, you know, to act on like something that we, if we say, hey, you know, we see something suspicious here, I think, you know, it's another opportunity for us to see where the government is failing, you know, where they're inefficient. You know, I think they kind of realize that they're inefficient and they wouldn't be able to handle it, you know, and so they're saying, oh, well, you know, Blogger is supposed to do this, you know, when it's not their job, but they know that if they were to try to do it, that, you know, they'd be accountable. And people would realize that they failed to do it.
Well, Lieberman also brought up that YouTube has a such a option, you know, a flag for terrorist content, I guess. I didn't know. I guess.
Well, it's a flag for any kind of bad content. You know, if it's sexual or has too many swear words or stuff like that.
Well.
I don't think there's actually a button that says, you know, click here if you think the person's a terrorist, you know. They'll say report this video.
Yeah, I that's the only button I've ever noticed is report this video, personally.
Right.
Let's, you know, I think we're at a prime spot to move on to soap. But what do you guys think?
It makes me think of like soap, the TV show.
You know what? I did see one editorial on it titled SOPA, the new soap opera. Anyways, let me just read through this right quick. SOPA, not well liked by many. Mike Masnick of TechDirt posted that many have been expressing a dislike for SOPA. The Stop Online Piracy Act, or H.R. 3261, is currently in committee hearings. One of the more popular news stories which came out about the public reaction to its potential law was the Free Justin Bieber campaign. The bill would make online streaming copyright offenses a felony with up to 5 years prison time, folks. Ironically, Bieber was sent a cease and desist order to Free Bieber, which was started by Fight for the Future. Apparently, he doesn't mind going to jail. Maybe he's going to go the dark side there. The Tech Dirt article lists the following as opposing the bill, and I may have to stop and drink a sip of water on this long list, but Hacker News, who has actually put up a site, and this one I want you to pay attention to, listeners, where you can send a representative a letter. You will fill out a form, and it will physically print a letter and send it to them. Clickable links will be in the show notes. The ACLU regarding free speech issues is against it. The American Libraries Association is part of the Library Copyright Alliance. The Association of Research Libraries is part of the Library Copyright Alliance. The Human Rights Watch, the New American Foundations on Open Technology Initiative, Tech Freedom, Freedom House, the Competitive Enterprise Institute over due process concerns, the EFF, They have many articles on that topic. Public Knowledge, Consumers Union, Consumer Federations of America, USPIRG, which is another consumer protection group, the Brookings Institution, Asset Over Security Concerns, and Tech America. And that's not even all of them.
You forget to mention IndyNation.fm.
Well, of course, but EFF lists even more who oppose the bill. And get this, there's an alliance actually being formed by Facebook, Google, Twitter, eBay, Yahoo, AOL, and Mozilla because what they think it's going to do to Internet commerce. The process of approving this bill has also come under scrutiny. Tech discussed that the committee is perceived as biased, and add to that, those opposed to the bill have not been permitted to attend the hearings. The EFF has more on those who are not permitted to attend and states that many of those who are permitted to attend actually helped draft the bill.
That doesn't pass the smell test with me. It don't.
Folks?
Well.
Say, what do you think, Cletta?
Doesn't fly with me either. I don't agree with that.
I mean, I number one. There was a previous bill that they listened to the tax experts regarding the security. And Brian, I probably need your help on this one. But basically what they want to do is shut it down via DNS.
Yeah, they want to do, you know, filtering. And I think that that's, you know, I think we're getting closer to what China does at that point.
Isn't that exactly what China does?
Yes. And, you know, and they're taking away our right to access the internet how we want to. They want to see all requests. I mean, because when you're doing DNS filtering, you're pretty much, when someone goes to say, I want to go to this website, the government's saying, well, you know, do we think you should be able to go to that website? And I think that this doesn't stop at, you know, with the software piracy. You know, this is the government then being able to tell us, well, do we agree with the point of view of the website you're going to? It gives them the opportunity to filter it even at that point. You know, I think that we need to draw a line in the sand and say, you know, here is, you know, here's where I believe that you have the right to interfere with my life, and here's where I don't.
And Mike Masnick, also over at Tector, and I'm going to put this link right in IRC chat, and I'll make sure this one gets in the show notes. He's got a real good article, and he calls it, oh, I don't have the right link in front of me. I will get the right link in chat and in the show notes. But basically, he put up a post. He calls it the definitive post on why SOPA and Protect IP or PIPA are bad ideas. And he brings up some great, real points. Number one, it's clearly censorship. I mean, it's clearly censorship.
How is it PIPA if it's PIP?
Protect IP. And IP stands for intellectual property.
And then A?
Act.
Oh. Or maybe they'd be copyright infringing on PIP.
I don't know.
The plumbing people.
See if they get sued.
Yeah. They probably researched it out just to make sure they weren't.
Sad thing is PIP probably does more for society than the RIAA and the MPAA combined because they keep our pipes clear.
Right. For those of you who don't know, Cletta and our... I'm sorry. I lost for words. No, our friend over there in Boise, Idaho. Home of the Smurf Turf. You know, it just, you know, PIP is a company here in Cleveland that does plumbing. And they also there's a PIP company that does printing, PIP printing.
Well, you know, one of the things that, the thing that got the attention on this post, on this act was the fact that it would basically make Justin Bieber a felon.
His online recordings, because isn't that how he started with
YouTube?
Doing covers.
I was gonna say you can't do that. He's got a family to raise now. He's gonna be a dad.
But the point is there's a reason that performance rights were put into the original copyright. The reason being is intellectual property rights were meant to protect your intellectual property from piracy, theft, plagiarism, ripping off. And performance rights were intentionally written in, because when you're Joe Blow Band playing out and you cover an artist, you're not ripping them off. You're publicizing them and paying homage. A lot of the Beatles' earliest songs were other people's material. And I remember reading a handwritten letter by John Lennon on the web where he said it wasn't a ripoff because somebody was accusing them of doing that in their early days. He said it was a love fest.
That makes me miss John Lennon even more.
But I mean, honestly.
Knowing he said that. That's great.
Honestly, though.
What would you think people like him would be thinking about this crap today? Do you think they'd be worried about, you know?
I think he was rolling over in his grave when he saw Revolution used as a Nike commercial.
Probably. Did the Beatles ever do a cover song of anything?
Yeah, they did a lot of them, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. They covered Chet Atkins.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have everything they ever did in sheet music in the living room. We can look through it and I could show you. They covered a lot of people's material.
Well, that's kind of cool.
As a matter of fact, they covered a lot of the people's material and made those people a lot of money, because before the Beatles covered it, nobody even knew who they were.
That makes a lot of sense.
So that's why performance rights were written in. And there is actually, I forget what it's called, compulsory rights, I think it is. If I do a cover and I don't drastically alter it so that you are not confused as to, you know, what song I'm covering, and I record it, there's actually a whole different scale of royalties for that recording. Did you know that?
I can imagine. I mean, that's why Typo Negative got sued by Seals and Cross for changing the words on, instead of calling it Summer Breeze, they called it Summer Girl. And then but when they actually released the record, they had to have Summer Girl or Summer Breeze on there. And I have a little promo tape with Summer Girl. And they changed the words and everything. It's like a parody, basically. You know.
Well, if it was actually a parody, it would be protected in the United States. But this is screwy, not in the UK.
They got sued by Seals and Cross, and they had to change it before they released the actual physical record on Bloody Kisses.
I drink
that in.
We touched on this earlier, and I'm quoting the article I posted in chat over at Geek Shed, but advertising giant Group M was asked its entertainment industry customers to compile a list of sites dedicated to infringement. And Universal, Warner Brothers, and Paramount were three key providers to that list, which ended up covering a large number of perfectly legitimate sites, including Internet Archive. It also included innovative startups that are frequently used by content creators to get their works out, such as SoundCloud and Vimeo. So as far as they're concerned, if I want to put my own stuff out there on a site dedicated for independent artists, that's dedicated to infringement. When did I sign a contract with them?
I don't know. When did you, Lumpy? I don't know.
Brian?
It seems like a lot of this comes back to the, you know, are we going to keep the internet free and open? And you start hearing more and more about that, you know, from different organizations. But, you know, all this is about regulating the internet, you know, because these companies, they don't like the idea that there's something that they cannot control, you know, and that's where this act comes in. You know, it's them wanting to have some form of control over the internet. But, you know, should the internet is not a United States thing. This is a worldwide thing. And, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to let them filter the internet as it comes into the United States? Or, you know, where, as I said, you know, you draw a line in the sand. You know, where is this going to go to?
Well,
I totally agree with that, Brian. Just like, for example, on Google Plus, you just about have to give your life history now to be on Google Plus. You know, the censorship is getting really, really bad online now.
Do you want to know how draconian they are, though? Cletta, you're going to, you know, they're shutting down your Groove Shark, which I know you love from all the tweets you send out.
Yes.
Now, you, have you guys heard of 50 Cent?
Yeah,
it's good. That's a dollar with John F. Kennedy on it.
But he's on Universal Label, right?
Yes.
Okay, and 50 Cent has got his own personal website, which is way more popular than the Universal site. So they put his personal website on a list of infringing sites. Their own artist.
Wow.
He doesn't own his music anymore. You know, I think it's turning around to, you know, I think that's where, like, you know, with the Indie Nation, with their music of indie music, the artist owns their music. And, you know, with them, they don't, he made it, but they feel like they own it. They, you know, he no longer owns it.
Okay, well, let's go a little bit further. I mean, basically, he's competing with them, right? Well, Monster Cable, who stated they support to protect IP, they put together their own list of rogue sites, okay? On that list is eBay, Craigslist, Costco, and Sears. So...
Well, you might as well just cancel having an industry at all, you know?
I mean, if you're a competitor, you're an infringer, right? You're a rogue. Geez. I mean...
You know, I have a question. If we all move to Mars and start inhabiting that planet, do any of these rules apply? You know, I'm serious. I mean, it's like you take something that is grassroots and got some, it's like wilderness. It's like untethered by humankind. It starts growing on its own and succeeding on its own, you know, and then you get these bureaucrats that got to interfere in. Do everything they can to make it impossible. I don't know, to me, is that's way over the top.
The other thing, I'm still over at this definitive post. This is going to be a heyday for copyright and infringement litigation attorneys. You think sue 'em all was bad? Now, the other thing is they want to incorporate into it something called secondary liability. And I think the best way for me to explain that to our listeners is, I used to be a landlord. Now, let's say we got some other people here and trying to chat with us in TeamSpeak, but they're just having some technical difficulties. But let's pick on OmniDragon for a second. Let's say I rent an apartment to OmniDragon. And let's say I rent the apartment to OmniDragon, and he decides to start selling crack out of the apartment. And in the process of one of his bad deals, he shoots a couple people. Now, does it seem logical that I should go to prison for his crime? I mean, I didn't have any idea who was going to sell crack or kill anybody, right? But I mean, what do you think? Should I go to jail for that? Should I be charged with something?
Well, they're going to say you facilitated. You gave them the platform or the place to do that crime. You know, I think when it goes to computer terms, that is what their excuse is.
But did I have any knowledge that he was going to do this? Did I have any previous? Okay. Here's the thing: if he moved in, started selling crack, and shot somebody, should I go to prison? Yes or no?
Definitely not.
Not you.
Okay. Now, if he moved in, was selling crack, and I saw him selling crack and knew he was selling the crack, and I renewed his lease, maybe then.
Well, compare that to what just happened at Penn State with this goofy assistant coach that's, you know, molesting young boys. And you have the head coach and Joe Paterno, who knew of it. He knew of it secondhand. He didn't really have any evidence. He didn't see the guy doing it. But then he took away the guy's access to all the facilities upon word of it, and he went to his superiors. Okay, he followed his own protocol, all right, but he still gets fired because he apparently didn't do enough. Now, all of a sudden, he didn't do it, but he didn't even do the crime.
But he had knowledge.
He had knowledge, okay, but like I said, he followed his own protocol that he was supposed to follow.
That's a good parallel, but here's where I'm going with this. If this becomes law and Joe Muslim Terrorist uploads a video to YouTube, and even if the people at YouTube aren't informed that it's how to make a bomb out of a cat, let's say, they're liable. See, you bring up a good point. He may have done what he's supposed to do and all, but the point is he had knowledge. Now, this terrorist website we're talking about in the Joel Lieberman letter earlier,
mm-hmm.
It's gone now. If you try to go to it, it's a 404. So once Google knew, guess what? Okay.
Gone.
If I'm a landlord and you're selling crack, guess what? You're out of my building. Okay, yeah. You're out of my building as soon as I can get the police there and as soon as I can get you into court. Because if I don't do that, I had the knowledge, okay? And, I mean, Joe Paterno, there's some political stuff and stuff there.
It's a completely different scenario, I understand. But, I mean, you're talking about somebody who's being fired for something they didn't even do. Now, you're talking about you going to jail for something you had no knowledge of, you know?
I don't know. The other thing is we mentioned, Brian, and maybe you can fill me in a little bit. I know you can elaborate on this more than anybody here. You're probably familiar with OpenDNS.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to read a little bit from Masnick's article. Experts spoke out very early about COICA in the pre-PIPA days, which is, I think, what it was before it evolved into this, to explain how DNS blocking would set back a decade or more's worth of work on online security standards, would make people less safe online, and has the risk of fragmenting the internet. As a matter of fact, OpenDNS's founder said, he might not have even started the company if he knew that this could happen.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you look at what OpenDNS does is, you know, it allows people to filter the internet. And, you know, they use that for protecting your kids. But also gives you a little bit of advanced features, you know, in DNS. And DNS is just the servers on the internet that tell you where different websites are, you know, and it's not actually blocking access to the site, but it's blocking your, I guess, phone book. You know, if you're looking for a person in a phone book, you look up their name. It's just blocking that access to the name of that place. And I think, you know, that was definitely not OpenDNS's idea. They weren't looking to prevent companies or websites from existing. They just allowed the consumer to choose, you know, do I want to filter this out or not? You know, I think it goes against the company OpenDNS's principles of what it's about, because I think they're looking at it as the consumer's freedom to choose whether or not they want to see something coming, you know, into their internet, not the government deciding if this is coming into your internet.
Yeah, and I asked you for help on that one because you're like the tech guru. And I know you do posting and you set all this stuff up and you understand it all that well. And, you know, I know quite a bit about intellectual property, but how would you feel about a judge determining what reasonable measures are for managing how the internet works?
Well, as a web host, you know, for me, I don't want to be held accountable for, you know, what my client hosts. Now, if I get told, as you said, you know, the landlord, if I get told, you know, this person has child porn on a site that I host, then it's my duty to take it, you know, to shut the site access off. But, you know, if I have no knowledge of it and, you know, and they're coming to me and saying I'm responsible, I'd be very upset, you know, because I'm not going through and looking at every website that I host constantly. And just, you know, it's the same thing with Google. It shouldn't be Google's responsibility to police the internet. It shouldn't be OpenDNS's responsibility to police the internet. And it shouldn't be my responsibility. I think a lot of this comes down to it should be, you know, the consumer's decision to whether or not they're going to break the law. And then it should be these companies' job to prove that they broke the law. You know, I think that's how it is right now for the most part, is they have to prove that someone broke the law. And I, you know, I'd rather not have them decide whether or not, you know, I should have the right to host websites, or I should have the right to have my own website or post content, you know, it's, or what I can post. If I want to post something, I should have the right to post it. If it's then found that it's not appropriate, you know, I should have the opportunity to take it down.
I also have to ask you, I got away from hosting.
I totally agree with you though, Brian.
Another relevant for one very relevant question, I think, for Brian regarding this SOPA and this PIPA. I got away from web hosting because I didn't want the extra work. I didn't want the extra headache. Brian, what would it mean to you as a web hosting provider if you had to police everything that went up on anything you hosted?
Well, one thing, first of all, you know, I'd have to invade the privacy of my clients. Because if my clients wanted to have the right to have a website up that was password protected, for me to follow this law, you know, if they were to put it in law that I had to monitor and I was held responsible for what they'd have, I would have to go through and get past their passwords and inspect everything that they do. I mean, for me, it'd be a huge hassle just to protect myself from these possible laws that could happen. And, you know, and also, you know, am I then held responsible for what emails they receive? You know, if let's say a terrorist is sending emails back and forth from a website account that's on my server, am I held responsible for those messages? I think that they think it's easy to say, well, you should be running filtering software or keyword searching software. And, you know, that's not easy to do, you know, especially...
Wouldn't you actually be violating federal privacy laws by reading their emails?
Exactly. You know, and I have a terms of service where I say, you know, you have privacy up until the point of where I receive a letter from a judge saying that I have that they have the right to access something that's under your account. You know, it's not my job to say, okay, well, I'm going to police you and make sure you guys are doing everything you're supposed to. And then if I see something wrong, I'm going to report you or I'm going to delete it. You know, I am breaking the agreement that I have with my client by doing the sort of things that, you know, what these different bills are kind of pushing you to do.
And you know, most of the server side email software and stuff, it's actually written in a manner where you can't easily access their account and you can't easily get, you could reset their password, but you don't, you know, at least all the software I've worked with, you can't actually see their password and access their mail, can you?
Well, with what I do, I have a way of getting into them, but you know, I choose, you know, I, that's part of the reason why they would host with me is because, you know, they know that I'm not going to go in there and look at their content, you know, because their email is their business. You know, and being a computer consultant, it's the exact same thing. I go through and I manage people's email servers, and there's a, you know, unspoken agreement that I'm not going to go through every night and read the emails that are coming into the system. But you know, there's still that level of privacy there.
I wonder how cPanel would feel about that, though, because you can't do that with their setup.
Yeah, well, and I actually I use a different piece of software that goes into the database, and I can look up passwords. And, you know, mainly it's for technical support. Someone, you know, one of my clients says, for some reason, I can't get into my email account, you know, and I can ask him, okay, well, what password are you using? And if it's, you know, someone that I know well that, you know, I have a personal relationship with them, you know, in dealing with them, I can say, oh, well, here's your password, you know. And, you know, I think that part of that is, you know, a lot of these places, rather than give you show you your password, they have you reset it. And a lot of that is for protection. But, you know, it's not easy for people to get, you know, I have to have root access to be able to see that. You know, and I think that everything, the way that these rules are going, it's going to force individual, you know, or website, you know, like Plesk with and cPanel to start encrypting everything. Because if it's something that is unencrypted, someone's going to be held responsible for that. I think all these companies are just going to start encrypting everything to cover themselves. And I would have to start encrypting everybody's email so that I don't even have access to it, so that I'm not held responsible for it. And it just makes everything a lot bigger hassle.
Then we'll just go the route of Europe and make encryption illegal.
Yep. And I think, you know, and that'd be the next battle. And I think that, you know, all this regulation, you know, with me, you know, it seems like it just comes down to personal freedom, you know, and, you know, a lot of it stems from money, but it does nothing to, like with piracy, when they go through and make all these encryptions and different ways of trying to protect these games, they're making it more difficult for the person who's playing the game, who has a legal license to play that game. It makes it more difficult for them to play it. If you look at they crack all that encryption. They make it, you know, they go right past it. And for them, it's easier for them to go and play a game than it is for the person who legally purchased the game.
But, I mean, what does all that encryption cost the software company, the email company? You know,
slows things down.
It
makes things a lot more difficult because everything is having to be decrypted and encrypted. It creates more bandwidth for things that are going over the air, and that makes a difference on some cell phones. You know, people having to cover themselves from these possible lawsuits, I think are going to be a large headache that hopefully is dealt with now, you know, by people saying, you know what, we're not going to put up with this regulation that you're trying to impose. We're not going to put up with this, you know, like with the SOPA, you know, so that they say, hey, you know, stop it now and let us be responsible for ourselves.
Well, I think maybe some closing thoughts on all of this. I think there's a couple of things that I see, but I'll hold my peace for a bit. Who wants to say something here? Omni, did you manage to get your mic working?
I think I did.
Hey!
There you are.
Hey.
What do you guys think? You've been pretty quiet. I've been trying to give Brian a little bit more mic time, but I think Steve and I have been a little bit too dominant, maybe.
I wonder if that's why
Yoda... What are your thoughts on it, Omni?
I wonder if that's why Yoda hopped off.
No, Yoda anything, was just listening.
Anything to keep the Omni Dragon out of prison. If I was renting from you and I was selling crack, hey, that's your problem, not mine.
I just had to pick somebody. I hope you're not offended by that. But, I mean, you know, the whole thing is like, I think that's a really good analogy. I could have picked Cluda, or I could have picked Brian, or I could have picked Steve. But, I mean, the point being is, you know, Brian, I mean, how would you feel if, I mean, okay, somebody sets up, you know, rents from you server space, and 2 days later you're taken to prison for a child porn that you had no knowledge of?
Yeah, that is hurting, you know, like with me, I'm a small, medium-sized business. And a lot of these regulations make it almost impossible for, you know, smaller companies to do these type of things. And you look at Google, you know, you look at the difference between GrooveShark and Google is Google has, you know, some companies are scared to go against Google, you know, if they're trying to say, hey, you know, you need to, you know, like what they did pretty much with GrooveShark, they're not going to go against Google because of they have the legal representation to be able to stop it. But, you know, the people that they do go after are, you know, the little guys like me. And, you know, and we're the ones at risk. They're not risking, you know, the big companies. They're not really afraid, but they're making it so that, you know, they're going to go after the small fish. And pretty much we're just going to be the ones that are punished. And, you know, I would hate to have to shut down my hosting company just because I'm worried about being sued. Or I'm worried about going to jail. You know, the people that are responsible, you know, if I have no knowledge of what's happening, the people that are responsible are the people that posted that content. You know, and I think a lot of these different sharing, you know, file sharing sites, the people that posted the content have to be the ones that are held responsible. You know, it can't be these sites, you know, they give a platform where someone can put a file up there. You know, so therefore they're wrong. Well, you know, that can be used for good or it can be used for bad. You know, why are we taking away the good uses of the product just because there's a possibility of bad? You know, it's like them trying to outlaw torrents. There's a lot of good uses for torrents. You know, if you want to go download, even look at like World of Warcraft, or if you look at, you know, Linux distributions, all these different places are legally using torrent technology to get the files out there, which takes a huge load off of these different companies that are trying to send out a large file. And, you know, with them trying to be overly broad, you know, and say, hey, you can't have torrents at all because there's a possibility they will be used for something bad, you know, is taking away that really good use that they're helping with. And I think that this is the similar thing, is we're going to have good things that are going to be hurt by these rules that are trying to stop the bad parts.
Anybody else got any thoughts on this topic before we call it a wrap? I had one more thing I wanted to close with. Hillary Rosen, whom I've known the name for years, may not be a name known to the listeners or the other people in this conversation. I think it says so in the article, actually. She left the RIAA as CEO in 2003. Now, we were talking about Mike Masnick and his definitive post. She actually caught a tweet about this post and tweeted back to Mike Masnick, quote, "The definitive post? ?" Think analog. If a store doesn't sell you what you want, you are justified in stealing it? Maybe it's time for them to think digital.
Oh, I think so.
I don't know, folks. I've had fun, and this is going to end the recorded part of this.
Mm-hmm. You have been listening to TechNet News and Opinion. If you would like to participate, please contact us at 818-81-INDIE or news@indienation.fm. We will talk to you next Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on indienation.fm. Until then, surf safe and keep it tuned to indienation.fm. Indie Nation listeners, Lumpy is asking for a handout so somebody can have a hand put on. Well, you can click on the Give Michelle a Hand tab at IndieNation.fm or go to giveforward.com/givemichelleahand and see if you can help us out. Either spread the word, put the widget on your website, or maybe donate. However, we'd love to get this amputee a hand.